Okay, calling the meeting to order. Okay, today is September the 22nd, 2015.
That's a long time.
I'm dating myself, sorry. Anyways, so seeing no member of the public, roll call.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Jason Gordo.
Present.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Maria DeAnda.
Sort of here.
Mike Lynch. Gordon Ford.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay. Do we have any announcements?
I do have an announcement. You may have noticed that you mistakenly received two Northern Trust reports. The Pyramus report was not in your folder. It is now in front of you, and we're sorry for that mix-up.
It was on the internet.
Yes, it was available online. That was your holdout.
And I just want to let you know that I will not be in attendance at the next October admin meeting. I've got to go keep up my actuarial credentials.
That doesn't mean
you need
to be absent, though.
Doesn't mean what?
What's the date on that?
What is the date on that?
It's
14, I think.
Yeah, it's a ways from now.
Not that far. Okay. Any no further announcements? Public comment? Maybe no public. Consent items.
Move approval.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Okay, that takes us to our annual performance report from Pyramus.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Thanks for having us in. So the nice thing about this meeting is we met a few of you in our office was that May or June?
June.
It was June. So no changes since then either. I think you guys have made some changes with your new consultant over there. So otherwise, it's business as usual at Pyramus. Things are going very well. I'm Kristen Schaffner, for those of you who I haven't met personally, but I'll be your relationship manager. I know a lot of faces from Sackers, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in November there. I sit on that program committee board, so if you ever do have ideas for sessions or things like that, I'd love to hear from you. Always good to get trustees and staff feedback on that. Brought with me today Brian Hosley. He's the co-lead portfolio manager for your strategy, so he's going to give you a little update. But, you know, business as usual Pyramus, where our assets are continuing to grow steadily. The president who we mentioned was new is, you know, very much in line with serving our institutional clients. So we're very happy with how things are going there. So if there's any questions I can answer about the firm or anything, happy to do that. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Brian, and he could talk to you about your portfolio. We did bring some numbers, and we were pleasantly surprised at always making money for you.
Not surprised at all. I just want to be sensitive to everyone's time frame. How much time should I allot?
I think probably about 20 minutes.
Okay. That's fine. I can do that easily. And I'll refer you to page 4 just to kind of remind you of the structure of the portfolio management team. Chris Stewart and I are the co-lead portfolio managers. Our primary role from an investment perspective is to allocate assets across the five regions. So that's Europe, Japan, the PAC base next Japan, Canada, and emerging. And then we have regional portfolio managers within each of those regions. We believe that a regional focus and expertise with a very coordinated global perspective works well. And I think our long-term numbers support that the process that we have in place. If there aren't any questions about the team or the process, I'll just jump right into kind of the environment that we've been operating in. And that's on page 11. And I apologize, most of these bullets were written back on around June 30th, early first week of July. So a lot of these are yesterday's news, especially given what we've seen happen since June 30th. And if you think back all the way back to June 30th, which in some ways seems like yesterday, but in many ways when we were thinking about the Grexit you know, the Greek exit from the euro. That seemed to be a long time ago that we were thinking about that. And that seemed to be such a big thing going on at that time. And the world economy, the European governments worked through that and came to what some of us refer to as agreement, as agreement to stick with it. I believed heading into this that Greece was not going to exit the euro at this time. I'm not so strong. I don't feel that strongly about it looking forward 18, 24, 36 months. I do believe that they may end up exiting, but at that time it'll be a much more negotiated process. And hopefully there won't be, the whole kind of volatility that was brought into the global equity markets, as well as kind of the civil unrest that was going on throughout Europe at the time. So I expect that through this period of time that they'll be figuring out a mechanism, which they don't currently have, to get anyone out of the euro, that they will come up with a mechanism that it will be a relatively calmer kind of occurrence if in fact it does, and I would give it more than a 50% chance at this point.
Didn't they have another election? Was it yesterday or today?
I don't know for sure. So since that, and we don't hold any Greek securities in the portfolio, and we didn't at the time, and I think since 2008, you know, maybe we've held one or two Greek securities in that entire period of time for a very short period of time. So, we have definitely kind of stayed away from it from an investment standpoint. But the bigger story that's happened since I wrote these pages back in June or early July was certainly the Chinese situation, where we've seen the Chinese A-share market skyrocketed up. Many domestic investors, Chinese domestic people put all their savings into the market. The markets got bid way up high. The margins, people were borrowing tons of money to invest in the market. It became a very big problem for the Chinese government. They had to put in kind of all kinds of regulations on how many on the sale of the securities, and it was very much of a very strong government policy kind of disrupted the equity markets. And then on top of that, they started manipulating with the RMB currency, their currency, which brought in significant volatility and uncertainty into the global equity markets that impacted all the markets across the world. I'm sure you'll recall, I think one day the Dow Jones opened up down 1,100 points, then it swung back up and ended up down about 500 or 600. It was quite a day. In those periods of time, and our portfolio management team is quite experienced. I'm kind of in the middle of the age group, so we've all been through this before. The first time I was through it was 1987 in my career. So during these periods of extreme volatility and uncertainty, sometimes the best thing is to do is just kind of sit and watch and see what happens. And that's exactly what we did for the most part within our portfolio. And that proved to work out pretty well for us. From a relative standpoint, we gained 100, 150 basis points during that period of volatility. So I think that was one of those questions that I was expected might be on your mind, so I wanted to address that straight up. That's not to say that on an absolute basis things have gone well. Aquiex US, which is your primary benchmark, was down 9.36% through, this is last Friday or maybe yesterday. In August alone, it was down 7.6%. As of June 30th, ACWI was actually up 4.3% or 4.03%. So quite a change that we'd seen during the third quarter. Kind of looking out on the outlook, and I'll keep this relatively short, but since 2008, we have been talking about what we viewed, the financial crisis, global financial crisis, and we viewed it as a very big problem, a long-term problem that was going to require a series of short-term solutions to correct itself. I would say we're maybe a little bit more than halfway through the kind of correction phase of this. In that environment, even back in 2009, we were looking at and talking about a global economy that was going to have very modest growth, so talking kind of 2.5% global growth environment, with pockets of strength and pockets of weakness. And we've seen those pockets kind of move around, where emerging and China were doing pretty well for the first kind of half of this period. Now both of those areas are not doing well at all. Europe seems to be picking up. Japan seems to be getting a little traction. The U.S. has done quite well, so but still with very, very modest global growth. And that's what we need to see, is some more across-the-board global growth that's going to help us get through this continued process of digging out of the financial crisis from now 7 years ago. If I had known that 7 years ago, I would have considered a career change maybe, but it has been a long, long path. So, you know, again, things seem to be improving on more on the developed market side of things, but a little bit tougher on the emerging side.
Brian, you mentioned a second ago that we're halfway through this process, I assume, of getting over this hump.
Yes.
So to speak. What, in your mind, would signal that we're close to the end of this process?
I think we need to see a lot more stability in the European financial system. That has to do with both the currency and the banking system there. That's still quite fragile. Probably needs to see some additional consolidation there. I think we need to see China get back on its feet one way or the other. They're in the process of moving from a very, you know, big government spending infrastructure build kind of economy into trying to develop their own sustainable domestic economy that's more service and consumer oriented. And they are in the process of doing that. And when they're in that process, that growth that many people got too used to of growth, GDP growth within China of 10-11%. Now we're back into, you know, we were at 7, now we're probably 6.5-6, and that's what the government's reporting. And the government numbers are always a little bit suspect. So still, 6% growth is very, very good for the second, or some people arguably will call it the largest economy in the world. But we clearly need to see more consistency in policy there, you know, better vision or better transparency of what is actually going on. There's a lot of overcapacity there that, you know, a lot of companies went in feet first, thinking they were just going to build out and build out and build out. And now, just within the auto industry, Volkswagen, for example, the auto industry in whole, the current market is about 25 million new cars a year, so 25 million units a year. That's the U.S. is kind of in the upper teens, kind of 17 million a year. It's a very big market, obviously. But the companies that it's a variety of companies, it's European car makers, it's a lot of joint ventures between European car makers and Chinese, and some American car makers, some Japanese, not so much Japanese, Korean car, Hyundai, for example. They have built capacity that will be coming online in the next couple of years for 40 million. We just don't see the growth to get from 25 to 40 million, despite the fact that the middle class continues to grow there, but we just need to see things improve in China. And I think that when we see that, that will bleed over into the rest of the emerging economies, as China kind of buoyed the emerging economies when they were at their kind of hyper growth stage. And then finally, the commodities markets are very depressed, and also a situation where there's a lot of overcapacity built into mining, into energy, pretty much any commodity you look at, outside of more food-oriented commodities. So we need to see some bottoming out of that market as well. So, you know, I said I hope it's a little more beyond half. At the beginning we thought it would be a 10-year time frame. We're at year 7, maybe. I don't think I'll be sitting here in 3 years saying everything's all great and rosy. We just don't see it. Everyone is very, very cautious right now, I would say. as from where we stand now, and that maybe some markets have gotten a bit ahead of themselves, and the U.S. is included in that. From a valuation perspective, from a future earnings perspective, but I think it's Chipotle, U.S. fast food. They're at 40 times earnings, which is just ridiculous. So you're paying now for 40 years worth of earnings, which is just doesn't work from a fundamental perspective. And those are the situations that people are getting, or that investors are getting very nervous about.
And the weakness in Australia, you tie that to energy partially. They don't produce
They do a fair amount. They have a lot of companies that do a fair amount of exploration offshore in that region down there. So that's where their energy exposure is, but they have a significant amount of exposure to mining, which is a big part of their employment picture, big part of their growth picture, and that's both depressed.
But their currency has been rising against the dollar.
It has recently been backtracking a little bit. In the last couple of weeks, it's been coming back up, but it dropped a solid about 10% since probably about a year ago. And then Eileen Dibb, who's our manager in the Pac Basin, looks over Australia. We're about 10% underweight Australia, and the bulk of that is Australian banks. And the Australian banks are very, very difficult for us as fundamental investors because throughout this seven-year period since the financial crisis, when there's nervousness in other parts of the world, especially within the European financials, so we've seen this in February of 14 when we had the Crimean crisis. There was a lot of nervousness within the financials within Europe. And we saw a lot of fast money moving out of Europe, out of Japan, into the Australian banks because they have been, throughout this period, relatively isolated from the rest of the world in this financial crisis situation. So all of a sudden, these stocks get bid up very heavily, very quickly, and from a fundamental perspective, we can't support going into them. We may buy them as risk control type purchases, but it hurts us on a relative basis because fundamentally they don't make sense to us. Now the banks are much more cheaply valued, and they are beginning to make some sense from a fundamental standpoint. So we're watching that currency very closely to see if it actually does pick up and get some traction, and then we'll start moving back into the banks. But the financials within the Pac Basin ex-Japan region make up, I think, 54% of the benchmark, and we're at about a 43 to 44% weighting within that. So we're significantly underweight there. But again, keeping a very close eye on it. And Canada and and Australia are very similar markets, very much energy and I think my comment there was probably more related to Canada than it was Australia. Very much more energy oriented in Canada, but also a big mining area up there as well. So that's kind of my overview.
That's a little doom and gloom, right? I'm not loving it.
Hey, I'm the optimist in the group.
3 years from now, you're not going to be optimistic. That's not really.
He'll be more optimistic, because I think that's
good. My job and our CIO looks to Chris and I kind of from an asset allocation perspective, and we have been underweight emerging and underweight Canada, which has helped us. But she's looking for us to get out there on the limb and really say something and kind of talk about what we're doing and trying to go overweight significantly in Europe, which we were poised to do in early August. We were going to go overweight Europe and overweight Japan and underweight the Pac Basin because we knew that growth coming out of the Pac Basin was going to be lower. What we did not know, and I wish I'd had a crystal ball at the time, fortunately we didn't end up doing this, but we did not anticipate the level of government manipulation coming out of the Chinese government. And I think we all have learned significant lessons from what we saw happen in August is that they'll do whatever it takes to keep up their own economy and undermine everyone else. So that is a quick lesson.
What do you say to those who believe that monetary policy has been used to such an extreme that if there's any kind of a recession or more serious downturn, that there's no way, nowhere for those economies to go to move on?
I don't have an answer for that because, you know, we can't lower our interest rates.
But it is a problem.
It's a big problem. It's a very big problem. And I was, quite frankly, a little bit disappointed that the Fed didn't make a move last week. I was a bit disappointed that the Fed didn't make a move last week because I think they had an opportunity where they could have gone up 25, even 50 basis points, so a quarter of a percent to half a percent on the back of improving employment numbers, some improvement in growth, improving wage numbers. So there was, people are feeling, I think, a little bit better about things, generally speaking, here in the U.S. And the U.S. has to be a leader in this. And I think if, in the business world, if the businesses that are, you know, have restructured their balance sheets and their whole operating structure to be heavy, much heavier debt because debt is so cheap.
Isn't the problem that the Fed's having is that they're just terrified of the unintended consequences?
Well, I think they're terrified of the Chinese at this point. And I think that that's an unfortunate... What's that? They are unpredictable, yeah. And that's an unfortunate situation. And I think that, you know, if the Fed... I believe that there's a huge amount of pressure for them to make a move in October, which would be off of their normal cycle, but they can certainly do it. So that would not be at all unprecedented. But I think that would be one of those things that we need to see happen, not only within the U.S., but globally, where we can feel more confident that we're moving beyond the financial crisis of 7 years ago, that we need to see some normalization of interest rates so that there is a bit of cushion built back into the economy. And that you know, the tools have been used and spent aggressively. And you know, I guess if I were, you know, if the economy were to fall off the cliff tomorrow and we were in another crisis, the government would pour all kinds of liquidity into the economy again, and we would be stuck where we are. We need to see global loan growth. You know, companies are not borrowing money the way they should be given the interest rates that they have. They're just not confident enough in the future to go out on the limb a little bit and to start borrowing money at these really, really cheap rates. And that's what we'll have to see a little bit more. And I think we have seen improved loan growth here in the U.S., and that is another support to kind of start raising interest rates very, very gradually.
Are we still in the same kind of a pattern as page 19 and 20 in allocation? And indicating different change
allocation? Yeah, no, we're exactly, very much in this range. We do a little bit of rebalancing to get back into where we need to be, but it's very similar to what you see on page 19.
And 20, the same thing. I know some people say interest.
Yeah, this has changed a little bit. You know, since certainly last year, where we are, our overweight to healthcare is new, our significant overweight to healthcare is new, and that's more of a fundamental factor than it is a fundamental and demographic factor more than it is a defensive play on earnings. A lot of the global, very large pharma companies that we typically invest in have moved beyond the patent expiration cliffs that they all faced, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. They have strong R&D. They're restructuring their companies. Roche is, for example, is, you know, typical, you know, 7 years ago was a typical very large pharma facing all kinds of patent expiration. They have morphed themselves into much more of a biotech-focused company, but they're still priced as a large pharma relative to biotech. So there's good transparent growth there, but it's still valued as a large pharma. So that's the type of company that we're investing in healthcare. And then also within healthcare, one of our names in New Zealand, one of our only names in New Zealand is Ryman Health. And Eileen is very optimistic about this name. They, given the demographics of both New Zealand as well as the rest of the globe where we have an aging population, Ryman Health specializes in elder housing, so you buy in a condo at the front kind of the front end of the development, and as you need additional assisted living, you kind of move back to different facilities where there's gradually more assistance, all the way to the end where it's full assistance. And that's a model that she really likes and she thinks can grow globally, and Ryman is trying to do that, growing globally, and they are have moved out of the Pacific region and they're doing some growth in the UK.
Most of the people who think interest rates are going up are saying that financials would be a good place to be, but that's your
you're
bleeding up and this is contract.
That is pretty much all of the Australian underweight that we have there. That 2.4%. We're roughly neutral in Europe. We're a little bit overweight in Japan, neutral in the emerging, and probably underweight in Canada as well. We still do have Volkswagen in this portfolio. Cedric did trim it prior to the emissions issue, and that was more related to the capacity issues that they have in China. They have a big market in China, especially through their Audi brand, but also through Volkswagen. They have a joint venture there. He was very concerned about the overcapacity and had probably trimmed about half of the name, half of its holding out of there, taking a lot of those profits. The emissions thing we could not have predicted. I have not had the opportunity to talk to him this week, but I'll have a meeting with him on Tuesday where I'll have better color on what his plan to do with that. I would expect that he will give that some time, given that it took such a hit early on, that he'll wait for it to come back a little bit before he makes any movement on that. We skipped over pages 15 and 16. Just real quickly, performance has been good for the last 12 months. Through June, we're up 304 basis points net of fees relative to the benchmark for 12 months. And then through August 31st, we're up 412 basis points net of fees for the 12-month period. So things have been working well for us. I think that this environment that I've been talking about falls very nicely into our fundamental stock picking approach, where it's a little bit more clear which companies are going to be able to have continued earnings growth relative to which companies are not going to in this type of environment. So you know, despite kind of the doom and gloom view that I've projected here, it's actually a positive thing for our process, as opposed to times when the markets, everything's selling off or everything's getting bid up. Japan is our one area of weakness that we've had, and this is an unusual situation in Japan, where Japan tends to be very much of a growth-oriented market. So far this year, it has been very much of a value-oriented market, where through yesterday, the Japanese growth benchmark was down 0.32% for the year-to-date through yesterday, and the Japanese value benchmark was up 6.26%. So we're almost 650 basis points or so of headwind on the value. So Eileen is not a value investor. It doesn't fit her process. She doesn't have strong conviction in value-oriented names in Japan. She very much likes high-quality companies, and they are just not in favor. But still, in light of that kind of 650 basis point headwind, she's down about 300. So she's struggling there, but she's sticking to her process. And these value markets don't last forever, and we have a lot of confidence that her process will come back into favor in Japan. But certainly in the Pac Basin, if you look at page 16, year-to-date, she's up 850 basis points there. 352 for the year-to-date. Joe over to Best in Canada is up 850. So I can stop there. I think I probably used up my 20 minutes, or I can take any questions. I can address whatever else you'd like to talk about.
Do we have any additional questions?
I was curious, though, you have a bank in in Africa, it was up to like 100%.
Yep.
Do you do much investing in Africa?
Well, it's about 20% of your portfolio through the emerging markets. You know, that's an emerging market that our Rahul Desai oversees. And that's Capitec Bank Holdings is the South African bank that you're addressing. It was the top performer of the in the portfolio through June of this year. And Rahul did very well throughout the kind of summer crisis, so I'll call it, through, you know, primarily with the Chinese issues. So I expect that bank continued to do well through you know, this period. It's been a really good holding and not an easy one for him to hold on to all the time because there has been, you know, some issues with the bank, but he really likes the management. He likes their model. It's differentiated from anything else going on in South Africa. South Africa's doing relatively well in the within the emerging universe of economies, so that's, you know, one of the reasons we continue to hold that one.
Okay. Is there anything else that you think we need to be aware of going forward besides some of the items that you just touched on?
The message I always like to leave is that we always stick to our process. And you know, 2014 was not a good year for our process, but as I probably said in June, and I don't think I was here last year, but when we have these periods of softness where we did in 2014, historically, and history does not predict the future, but historically we have stuck to our process. We've taken opportunities of those weaker market periods to improve the quality of our portfolio by investing in names more cheaply than we normally could, that we really, really like, getting rid of some that we don't like so much. So basically improving the quality of the portfolio, and when we come out of those periods of weakness, we tend to do quite well, as we have done this period again. And I think that's all attributable to the experience and professionalism of the team and really just sticking to that process and not overreacting to what is going on. And, you know, if I could, I wish I could make a list of all of the short-term crises that we've had in the last 7 years where we're all like, oh, what are we going to do? The trick is just to sit tight and stick to your process.
And I guess that would be my question, is at what point do you say, okay, we've stuck to our basics, our philosophy, and it's kind of lasting longer and longer? Because you're right, we have no control or anticipation of the direction China's going to go with. And they've shown that they can have a much larger influence on the global economy.
Yep. You know, every little crisis is different. I think, typically we can isolate the periods where our portfolios are negatively impacted in these weaker periods to maybe 6 weeks, you know, of what seems like forever. You know, last year it was late of the first quarter and into the second quarter, maybe it was a little longer than it, maybe it was 9 weeks. After that, things started coming back and working for us, and it was all about, you know, having confidence in the companies that we have, looking at them every day, talking to the research analysts, talking to the companies, just making sure we have a good feeling for what's going on, good transparency for what's going on. And, you know, if China were to, you know, really change up the playing field, I think we would be aware of that and astute enough to figure that out. I think we have done that in many instances where we've stepped away from a lot of the industrial companies that have a lot of overcapacity there, or just don't have the revenue stream coming out of there that they did 3, 4, 5 years ago. Those are examples where that's just kind of fundamental investing, where the playing field has changed, where they're not as much of an industrial infrastructure build-out story as they are a consumer service-oriented story.
And this is a question, the answer to which I may have missed before, but what kind of information sources do you have in China?
We have a lot of...
You have moles?
No. I was there a couple... 2 years ago, June, for about 2 weeks. A lot of people spend a fair amount of time there. We have a pretty significant research presence in Hong Kong. that those guys spent a lot of time in China and looking over with China, and you know, we were on the you know, we do a lot of video conferencing with them, especially during the crisis in August, and we expect them to be kind of our ears and eyes and hands for the feel of what's going on there in those periods of time, and all the time, but especially in those periods of kind of crisis. We have a lot of people that are government experts that are kind of in tune or try to be in tune to what's going on with the government there. It's, you know, obviously, I'm sure there's probably a couple of people that have spent their entire careers doing that for us that we can tap into, as well as many, many external resources that we have available to us.
Thank you.
I don't think anybody can predict what China's going to do. I mean, look what they did with the yuan.
Yep. You know, and I
nobody saw that coming.
And I agree with you 100%. The thing that we can do is analyze how long can they keep this up. You know, they spent $94 billion worth of their reserves. How long can they continue to keep their currency where they want it to be? You know, as far as them imparting regulations on equity trading within their own people. You know, when the A share market opened up earlier this year, we did invest in a couple of A share names within Raul's portion of the portfolio, but Eileen and many other investors did not, who are not emerging market managers, steered clear of the A share market because we still aren't sure of corporate governance there. We still aren't sure of what you're actually going to own if you own a share of that. You know, so there was still a lot of uncertainty, and we stepped away from that for the most part. We do have a couple of names that have done very well. On page, what number is this? 17. Kwai Chow is an example. It's probably one of the only A shares that we have in there. They have a 51% of the Beijing market there. And Beijing is, I was offered some when I was in China, and it's their, what they drink socially and in kind of official settings. And apparently it's a terrible tasting kind of white wine thing. But the Beijing market took a very significant dip when there was a lot of graft going on in China, when there was a lot of people showing off their money because they were all buying the luxury brandies and scotches and champagnes out of Europe and drinking that at their official dinners and all that kind of thing. And the new government has clamped down on that. So this is an example where it's a Chinese company. It's on the Chinese exchanges as an A-share, but it's got very solid, transparent earnings growth and some structure there, and it's got a huge market share. So that's the type of company where we're a little bit comfortable owning that.
But the Japanese were doing the same thing a few decades ago.
Yep. Yeah. And I think we look at that pretty closely too. And you know, it's very similar to what's happened in Japan back in kind of the 60s and 70s, where Japan, you know, took on all kinds of production and then they started moving the labor offshore to some other economy, maybe China. And now China's doing a lot of that, too, where they want to get away from making widgets and making more, you know, high-tech, having a more technologically trained labor force as opposed to just kind of standing there watching a machine go by.
Can you tell me that China will lower its currency and devalue it?
Yes. Yeah, that's what we were talking about, the currency manipulation in August, yeah.
Well, we just want to reiterate how important this relationship it is and how much we appreciate your business. I mean, we only get to see you once a year, but, you know, when our portfolio managers are managing it, you're top of mind on a daily basis, so we appreciate it. Okay. And we'll see you in November.
Thank you all.
Barris. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
First official meeting.
First official meeting. Thank you. I am very pleased to be here. So I understand I should keep this short. I'll try to do just that.
Reasonable. We kind of go by a certain target of time, but obviously if there's information that you feel we need to hear, then we need to hear it.
Absolutely. I will keep that in mind. So we have, for this purpose, the Northern Trust Performance Report is what I'll be referring to. And I think I'll just refer to it briefly because typically, we don't do a lot of commentary on monthly performance. We don't get a lot of information from the managers themselves on a monthly basis. We get it more on a quarterly, and we spend time analyzing that deeply for those quarterly reports. But it is great to have a monthly checkup and see where things are going, especially in this market environment. So as we turn to page, 4, we can see the top line results for the month of August. And I don't know if these strike anyone here as being surprising or not, but for this individual month, we are down 4.5%, 4.49. And actually, I would normally tell you whether this is gross or net of fees. I don't know how Northern Trust
gross.
Is calculating. So it I figured,
is.
Yeah, okay.
It's gross.
It looked like gross to me as well. So this is gross of fees. So net is even down a little bit further than that. So this is a bit of a storm. And if you think through what we've endured in second quarter, and then July, and now August, and what we're seeing in September, we're not seeing a lot of optimism out there yet, and it's not turning into portfolio results either.
It's almost like the markets are reacting to every little bit of social or world information that's going on, and again, it's that knee-jerk reaction type of a thing.
It feels like that. I completely
like
agree with you. And we're also in this nice time frame where we're in September and earnings releases will start coming out in October again. And that, to us, is something you can really put your hands on, that earnings announcements matter and we can get a sense of it. Right now, it's a lot of speculation. It's what the Fed did or didn't do last week, what the Fed will or will not do in October or December and so forth. But it's very much speculation. But one thing we can talk about is overall, and as Brian just mentioned in his presentation, the growth story has really changed. And the growth story is what your portfolio hinges on. And when you take a look at it at the highest level, you have about 65% allocated to equities and a little bit under 30% allocated to fixed income and then the rest in real estate and private credit vehicles. And those assets are really geared towards, and they will do well in a growth environment. And as we see growth come off the table, we see these kinds of portfolio results. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not critiquing that in any way. I'm just saying that when you think about what's going on in the world and you take a step back and say, let's look at the forest as opposed to the trees, you can almost guess, okay, knowing what I'm seeing in the headlines, this is what we should expect. So then just taking a look through the individual managers, we see a nice allocation to indexing, which obviously we're fans of in terms of saving fees, can be very effective. And we see a healthy usage of that, both in S&P 500 core, large cap core exposure, large cap growth, and then a balance with using Jackson Square for active management. And Jackson Square has a nice long-term track record, and we know them from other relationships, so it tends to be a more concentrated portfolio with lower turnover. And so they're sticking to their knitting during a time where we're seeing them down 7% for the month. And then as we get into the value side, again, indexing and Dodge and Cox. Dodge and Cox, also another manager that likes to roll up its sleeves and get to know each security very well and is very patient in enduring times like this, which pays off in the long term, but is obviously having some long-term or short-term troubles. When we get into small cap, we have the Fund of Funds Legato, using managers that are under $2 billion. I'm sure we'll talk more about Legato in the future. They're having a little bit of downturn here, but actually outperforming their index. So at least gross of fees, they're outperforming for the month. Page 5, again, looking down through the small cap value side, Capital Prospects providing you with the active management here. Also a bit of underperformance relative to their index. And boy, we're just seeing consistent 5 and 6% declines during the month, and even more for the three-month periods. International Equity, LSV, your quantitative manager, on the value side, has about 22% allocation to emerging markets. And as we just heard, emerging markets were a difficult place to invest over the past month and quarter. Similarly with Pyramus, they had about a 20% allocation there and lightening up on it. So that's intelligent portfolio construction in that you're getting active management in a way where the managers can allocate to or from emerging markets as they see fit. So we're basically hiring them to make that decision. That makes a lot of sense to us. Right now it's a challenging market, and we're seeing how Pyramus is underweight because of that. So they're doing the right things, but obviously a tough headwind there. On page 6, getting into the fixed income side, Dodge & Cox, which tends to own more corporates, investment-grade corporates, mortgage-backed securities, underperformed a bit. Also, they have a lower effective duration of about 4 years versus the benchmark at 5.6, which is just an indication of how sensitive that portfolio is to changes in interest rates. And because they're shorter duration, they're well positioned for a rise in rates because the portfolio will do better. But actually, rates have come down, and we're sitting here today with a U.S. 10-year Treasury at about 2.15% or so. PIMCO. So this is one notice we wanted to make you aware of. PIMCO received a Wells notice regarding their ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund, not what StanCera is invested in, but it's similarly managed. And they received a Wells notice on that. And Wells notice means that the SEC basically is stepping up their investigation, that they can conduct an investigation on any investment manager whenever they want. When they announce a Wells notice, that's an intent to take civil action against them. So this is serious. This is something where they are saying, we examined your practices, your policies and procedures. It relates back to their bond ETF back in the 2012 timeframe. And they didn't like how they were valuing securities. And that's a pretty important piece of information to us. How a manager values securities is very key in terms of the performance they generate. And it's also very important in terms of when investors buy and sell shares. So if they're buying and selling at an artificially inflated or artificially deflated price, they're not getting a fair price. And that's a big issue. And managers take that very seriously. And it's well outlined in terms of SEC regulation and 40 Act regulation, how you play these rules. Okay, there have been violations in the past that have been egregious, and the SEC has clamped down on that. And so it's very clear today how you should manage that. So the fact that they're getting a Wells notice on this is a red flag to us. Verus has PIMCO on organizational watch, meaning that we as are looking at the organization overall and are concerned about the political sort of tensions with Al Arian's departure and then Bill Gross's departure, and then as a result of the management changes there. And that gives us some pause. With regards to those strategies that were specifically managed by Bill Gross, we recommended that our clients get out of those, that it's a very competitive marketplace, and where there are better opportunities, we've looked at alternatives for most of our clients. So seeing that they're receiving a Wells notice now is, again, another issue for them. It gives us some concern, and we'll be talking, I'm sure, about how we should be thinking about this. That being said,
who would be the two or three managers in your stable to take that role?
It's a great question. We actually probably have about seven or eight that we'd
like. Who would be the top two or three?
Well, so that's where I was going with it. To get to the top two or three, we would want to consider the overall portfolio construction. So we'd want to be thinking about which managers pair with Dodge and Cox the best. And so we would want to take a look at kind of a combined analysis and think of it in that way. Or if we are changing directions in any way with the portfolio, what we would want to do there. When we look at PIMCO in terms of being a sort of macro top-down manager and who else does that kind of thing, some of the good ones are like TCW MetWest. They have a similar top-down approach. Their portfolio construction ends up looking different than PIMCO's does, but it is one viable alternative.
Yeah. I have a question, Ed. I don't know if you know this, but you can just give us your opinion. Do you think there's any correlation between the Wells notice and the departure of Gross and Clarion?
I don't. The Wells notice ties back to 2012, and I think that even if the Wells notice turns out to be of substance, it will result in something along the lines of a fine, something along the lines of reimbursing shareholders who were negatively impacted, something like that. It would not have really impacted their day-to-day jobs. And
so it's not a case of the inmates running the asylum since the warden left.
Right. We would also want to think then about how we would move quickly or what a contingency plan may be, which could be another step in terms of thinking about if more bad news were to come out about PIMCO, what would we do? What's our plan? And that's just probably healthy to think about any of our investments, thinking about, you know, in the equity side, it's actually pretty easy because we have a lineup of indexed managers there already. We could easily move from the active to the index and say, okay, we're still in the market, we're just not with that manager. Here it's a little different, and we could introduce passive investing in the bond world or something of that nature. And then the other, just to wrap up the performance report, the other managers we had for real estate with some value add with American, BlackRock getting you some REIT exposure there, and then with Greenfield, and then infrastructure looks to be new and a building piece of the portfolio here. And then your direct lending, which are private investments. So these commitments have been made, and they are continuing on. Medley is obviously more mature, and Raven Strategies and White Oak are continuing to build. That's all I have for a performance report so far.
Just a silly question kind of thing, but if you were going to construct a portfolio, you were going to just do it from scratch.
Yeah.
How closely would what you would construct reflect to what we have?
It would likely look different. But what we're talking about doing and what I'll be touching on later is how we move through a process to get there and how we do it collectively. So it's going to be a multi-step process of understanding what the needs are, what the board's interests are, how you all work together, how we'll all work together, and develop that process. So I'm going to be touching on that in a moment.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
So, do we have any items for closed session?
No, not for me.
Okay. All right, that takes us to members forum.
Nothing from me.
Pass.
Do you have anything for...
I want to thank Donna for recommending the CalPERS program. I found it more than a little educational and not quite as tiring as Berkeley. But the suggestion I would make for the future is that CalPERS should be first and Berkeley should be second.
Good to know.
And they gave us a couple of rewards, a nice folder, and this.
Very nice.
Oh, one more thing. The call for CRCEA is out. Part of its program is something we got at CalPERS, and that's Rights and Responsibilities of Trustees. Might be a good place for Samuel to start.
We are going
to
have...
It's such a smaller gathering, it's a more intimate gathering, and you have more opportunity to talk with the principals and with the speakers and get a little more... I think you can get a little more out of this than you can out of CalPERS.
So this goes back to Joan's request a couple of meetings ago to have this added for an educational opportunity. So we will be putting it on the next admin calendar. It'll be coming up as an option for you. But because of the timing of it, it'll go out to you ahead of time so that you can take a look at it. So that if it does get added to the calendar next admin, you'll be prepared to know if you want to go or not.
Yeah, it's just in Stockton this time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Just as a note, since it's just in Stockton, if there was a couple of things that you would want to see, you know, you wouldn't have to stay for the whole conference. You could go and take the class or see the sessions that you're interested in and blow the rest off.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have to stay till Wednesday because Monday and Tuesday are the big days. Wednesday, they take care of their own internal business rather than... It's different. It's not something that...
It's not education.
Yeah, it's a business meeting. It's the business meeting, much like the one at Sackers, where I got to the privilege of...
Right.
You're back on.
Yeah, it's really only Monday and Tuesday.
So it'll be on your next agenda.
I'd like to forfeit my time to Trustee Grover.
I would have to do the same thing.
I just want to remind Joan she has to report those things on her 700 form.
Okay.
Other than that,
why I didn't accept one. I disclaimed it.
I'd like to request legal counsel look into the CFPB SID process and report back to the board. April 14th, I wrote to White Oak with concern that some of the investments, such as Selling Source, may not be legal. May 21, 2015, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, issued a civil investigative demand, or CID, to a subsidiary of Selling Source. June 10, 2015, Selling Source filed a petition to set aside the CID. It's my understanding that the process so far, at that point, was not public. On August 6, 2015, the CFPB denied the request. That is public. Here's a copy. Pass that over. I would suggest at minimum, White Oak should have kept us informed.
Is that it, Gordon?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Sam?
I will not be in attendance on the next meeting, the 14th. I have additional training out of county for the week.
Thank you. Kathy?
Just so Jason knows, I have not dropped the ball on this, getting this room and all this stuff done. I actually have a meeting. Okay. It takes forever to get anything done, but I am still working on it.
What were you going to do with the room?
Maybe redecorate it, maybe blow it out, maybe finish up the other side, at the very least, get the air conditioner working better. Tomorrow I'm actually meeting with Matt Innes from GSA because Capital Projects
will
do this project, but I need somebody who knows how to do the government process to get all the RFPs, because I have to get an RFP to get design plans done to get things started.
He's really, really busy. Please make sure not to slow down our work.
Well, Capital Projects won't touch it. So the gentleman that Donna has hooked me up with is actually a contract employee for GSA who will take on a smaller project such as this and help get me going in the right direction.
Delegation,
I honestly don't even know all the bits and pieces I have to do, and I don't want it to kick back on any of us that we didn't do it right. So.
And he can help write a script.
Yes, and he said he's going to be over here tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and he's tried. I've come over a couple times and hasn't made it over, so we haven't forgotten it.
Thank you for the update.
Sorry, please don't move.
It doesn't go very fast. It's got all the needs and dollars.
Okay.
Have you seen my office?
It would be an opportunity to do so.
I would invite anyone to come to my office. In fact, all y'all can come anytime you want. You've been there.
Ms. Kelly?
I have nothing else.
I have several things. One, the meeting's not quite over with yet. We're going to have... The meeting's not quite over with yet. We're going to have Ed get back up there, and he's going to explain what's coming down the pipe in terms of things that we're going to do. And he's going to be getting in touch with you and talking about investment philosophies, and he'll touch on the asset liability study and another workshop that we're going to be having. And then I wanted to let you know, just to kind of continue to manage expectations here. I know I mentioned this at our last meeting, at the admin meeting, that there were a couple things on the strategic objective that were slated to be finished this year, but we're going to be pushing them off to next year because we have a new consultant on board. And Kathy and I went down and discussed with Ed at his office a couple Fridays ago about a lot of these issues. We spent, what, 5 or 6 hours together. It was a very productive conversation. But the two issues that I were talking about a couple weeks ago was, again, the board wanted to institute a formal manager assessment and disposition policy. We haven't done that. That's slated to be done this year, but we will be working with Ed, and we figure to have that done, at least a preliminary draft ready at the January workshop he will discuss. The other issue was the de-risking strategy that the board put on our plates a couple years ago. That's something that we're going to get more input from you at the asset liability study in December, and then we'll bring back something to you sometime in quarter one of 2016. And then the other thing is Legato and Pyramus. As you may know or not know, both of those firms are still on watch here at the organization. And so we spent some time talking about their disposition, and Ed kind of wants to wait to get a feel for how you feel about investment philosophy and risk, and then we're going to discuss their disposition probably sometime after the January workshop as well, as what we decided to do, I guess. And so, again, we're just kind of managing what your expectations are of staff, what we have on our plate to do, and how we're going to go about accomplishing those things over the next 4 or 5 months.
What's the structure? You're going to have a facilitator? Or
what? I'm going to turn this over to Ed. That's a good segue into his presentation.
Oh, yeah. I figured it was a fancy point. Do I get to push a button?
Nope. You didn't get it. Took that joy away from him.
Just get to be near
it. We get the water tower and, you know, we'll just have another coat on the days we have this here on our side of the fence.
There.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I can see fine.
We need a demo.
Good idea. We'll put it on the list. Yeah, go right ahead.
Leave my list alone.
Feel free. I don't know if I'm violating protocol.
I'm going to ask you to speak up just a little bit louder.
That would be good. Okay. So this was a we call it in the bottom there in the small font investment strategy development work plan. We tend to use the three-letter acronym ISD a lot. Investment strategy development. That's a key part of what we're going to be doing over the next probably 5 to 6 months, really. And the investment strategy is a good chance for us to all get on the same page, for us to look at the portfolio very critically, and for us to examine past practices, what's worked, what hasn't worked, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing, what are current best practices, what should policies be looking like. All these kinds of things are all going to come together, and that's a great time for us all to do it as you're bringing on a new consultant and as I'm bringing on a new client, and we're going through this exercise. So I want to outline for you exactly what steps we're going to be taking through this. And it really comes down to, okay, nice. So it really comes down to this schematic, which I think is pretty handy. Monitor, assess, design, and implement. And they're continuous, and that's the nature of the circle showing there, that you're never done with one before you're starting the next. But what we're going to do is start this process off by looking at the assess and working through the design steps. And the assess is what we break out in terms of current state assessment first. And current state assessment is just that. Let's understand where we are today collectively, make sure we're all on the same page, make sure that there aren't anything hidden, anything I don't know, anything you don't know, make sure it's all out on the table. We have a very clear understanding. And it's not just the investment portfolio, it's also the liabilities, understanding the total plan and where we stand. And the next step of that ties into enterprise risk tolerance assessment. And we call it enterprise risk tolerance because what we're trying to look at is what kind of risk can StanSara take on?
you're all fiduciaries of a plan and you're looking out for your participants. What investment risk can you take with this portfolio that works, that doesn't put the plan sponsor in danger, right? Not that your board responsibilities are to the plan sponsor, but we have to understand where that guardrail is, and we don't want to run amok of it. So we want to have an assessment of the enterprise risk tolerance to help us gauge that. It really comes down to what's the financial health of the sponsor, which is why we have plan sponsor review there. The other piece is one-on-one trustee and staff interviews. So I plan on spending a healthy portion of October up here, meeting with each one of you for a good hour, hour and a half, trustees and staff, and talking about a nice sort of systematic way of thinking about what are your investment beliefs, what do you know about the portfolio, what would you like to know, what do you think is being done right, what is not right, and we'll collect those and aggregate them. They're all kept confidential. Whatever you say to me is kept confidential and anonymous, because we'll be using comments and quotes later, but we won't be citing who said what. We'll just have a good, healthy dialogue about that. And that'll help you all get to know me better, and it'll help me to get to know all of you better, too. And it's part of that getting everything out on the table and make sure we understand. So one of the key takeaways from today will be scheduling those interviews. I'll probably come up here for a couple days or something like that and make sure we can put together a plan of attack to either meet here or local Starbucks or McDonald's or whatever works. Sit in the park if we want to on a nice fall day. That works too.
You have golf clubs?
I do. I've been outlawed from using them. They told me not to throw them anymore. So that'll be that part, the assessment part. And then the design phase is this ISD workshop. And the workshop is going to be a time, and these bullet points are kind of rough. These are general, not customized. We'll customize them more as we learn more. But this workshop generally is a time where we can go through and think about targeted education, certainly the asset liability study, we want to have that included, and governance best practices. So again, thinking about how we do the things that we do and what should we be doing. Also thinking about the asset allocation and the investment policy statement itself, and making sure that the investment policy statement appropriately codifies what we're trying to do here, and that the asset allocation really makes sense for what we need to design in terms of return expectations, volatility and downside expectations, liquidity needs, all of those good things.
What's ISD?
That is Investment Strategy Development. Yep. So just in a little bit more detail then, current state assessment, we'll take a review of all your plan docs, your investment policy statement, other relevant policy statements regarding perhaps liquidity management programs or what have you, the investment manager agreements. Evaluate the portfolio structure. So, Michael, this goes right back to your question about if we were to start clean slate and look at the portfolio. First, we're going to start by fully understanding why the portfolio is constructed the way it is and how that's worked or hasn't worked. And then manager structure, taking a look at how we've employed the managers, what responsibilities we're assigning to them and delegating them, and how we're overseeing that versus what we're controlling in terms of the overall plan. The enterprise risk tolerance assessment. This is, again, trustee staff interviews, economic environment review, and board review and reconciliation. So this is very much what I already spoke to. So this combined with the review of the sponsor. And then the investment strategy development exercise overall, looking at asset liability modeling. We have that started. That's about a two-month process to get going. So that will be actually formally presented at the December meeting. Strategy heat map. This is a lot of fun. Everyone loves a good strategy heat map. I haven't shown that to you yet, but it's basically a way of looking at different portfolio structures lined up against your constraints, your liabilities, employer contributions, what have you, funding ratios, and saying what's the right thing for me or us collectively. And it's a pretty interesting exercise because it really makes you think about, A, there is no silver bullet, and B, all of these have pluses and minuses, so which one do we kind of land on at the end of the day? Then we have the ISD workshop itself, asset allocation modeling, the workshop, and investment policy statement. So the statement will also take some work in terms of thinking about where we are today and what should best practices reflect. And then here we have the proposed timeline. So this lines up with our next coming board meetings. So the current state assessment in October, that's probably at least half an hour, probably closer to 45 minutes for something like that. ERT assessment and 3Q performance report, this will be a good hour at least. Asset liability workshop, specced out separately. This will be the asset liability study. And then the ISD workshop. So here, these two workshops, these will both be off-site, right? This will be. So these will be times for us to step away from the table, and we can start working through a lot of good things in both of those. And then we start getting into actual implementation in March. And so we have the next several stages outlined, and then a detailed work plan that we've been working through with Rick and Kathy to get the process going. And part of that is just getting your performance report set up. That is being designed now. So we'll have something for you for your 3Q report, and we'll be up and running.
How has the transition been with SIS?
It's great. From my perspective, Kathy could probably plead a little more, but it's been
fantastic. They've been very helpful. They took care of everything just as quickly as we needed it. As we reached out to Graham for the stuff he needed, he got it over there fast. So as far as any of the electronic data that needed to move, it's already done. That piece of it's already done. And we gave Ed at least, a few hundred pages worth of documents to read.
That's right.
That's probably the slowest part is reading all the
documents. A few hundred pages.
Yeah, a few hundred pages of documents to read. But yeah, all the electronic stuff went quickly, and nobody even hesitated. They all worked quite professionally together to get it done.
Great.
Okay.
So these meetings you want to have are when?
Right.
The 101s?
Oh, so we need to schedule those. So in terms of scheduling them, I will need probably access work for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you
know what part of October you'll want to do that? Or
hopefully earlier than later. First or second week would be great.
Okay.
We need to have the results of that ready. That won't be a huge part of the current state assessment. They'll tie in more to November. So yeah, we'll try to get them in early October.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? I don't have anything. I was going to bring up something from the meeting I went to on Friday, but I can't remember it right now. I remembered it earlier, but now I can. So only in my head. Anyway, so with that, we'll adjourn the meeting, unless anybody else has any other outstanding items.
Sure.